It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Friday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber, Mike Santoli at the New York Stock Exchange. Cramer has the morning off. Futures get a bump this morning from both Tepper and Druckenmiller, who blessed this market's momentum, and that's helping us look past a host of downgrades today, some weak reports out of the transports. Europe's rallying about 1%. Housing starts the best monthly print in over a decade, and 10-year 1.83. Our roadmap begins with the resilient rally. Stock set for another higher open as Wall Street looks to close out a record-setting week.
Plus, Peacock joins the streaming wars. We'll give you new details on how Comcast's forthcoming platform looks to separate itself from the streaming flock.
And joining the four-comma club, Alphabet now with a market value of more than $1 trillion. Top five U.S. tech companies worth a staggering $5.2 trillion altogether, or more than 17% of the S&P 500.
All right, so stocks looking to hit some new record highs. We're getting some upbeat news on the economy as housing starts rise in December to their highest level since 06, up 16.9. And just to put that into perspective, we were looking for an increase of just 0.4. Amazing statistics, Eve. And then, of course, the commentary from both Tepper and Druckenmiller over the past half hour has done a lot.
Yeah, it's all fed in the same direction. I think we're going to maybe pick apart if weather was a factor in the housing starts and all the rest. But that is when the equity futures took another leg higher, when those numbers were reported. It comes after we got some other good housing data this week. Yesterday, retail sales better than expected. It's just become very hard to decide that the headlines are going to get in the way of a market that's been on this autopilot higher. I just think that, the guys like David Tepper and Stan Druckenmiller, they know better than to get in the way of a market that seems to be working in a tape that's very, very refreshed every day by really strong credit markets and people feeling a little bit too cautious coming into the year. We're going to reach a limit to this. On every metric, the indexes are very stretched and sentiment is getting a little bit overexcited, but it's been very, very hard to pluck out that point to say, okay, it's done enough in the short term.
Heading into earnings season, of course, there was a never-ending chorus of people who come on our air talking about, well, earnings are going to be really important. They're going to have to justify these multiples. We've only gotten the financials for the most part. What's your sense at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are essentially saying, oh, this reminds me of the last three quarters or so where expectations are super low. Every company's got to come out and beat by a lot. The reactions won't necessarily fit.
No.
And they don't always. But I do think it's sort of enough to keep that storyline intact to say that we are in an improving trend and not otherwise. Now, by the way, we're talking about the top five, NASDAQ stocks driving things. It's not about earnings. Not about this quarter's earnings. It's about many, many years worth of earnings that the market is betting will continue to come through. So it's a short-term, long-term. But the banks didn't hurt in terms of the earnings picture this week.
Right. Nothing that they're not leading the way, but nothing that occurred there is going to stop anybody's belief in the momentum of the overall market or the ability to continue to pay these prices.
We're in the kind of virtuous circle point of this rally where it's sort of like everything seems to be working it's hard to decide when it's going to overshoot. Now, you got some transport names.
I was going to say
that are not working.
CSX volume down 7. They see another challenging year. KSU sees low single digit growth in 2020. Expeditors Q4 activity weakened dramatically. How long do we look past weak December data, at least in transports? Weak Q4 data.
That's a very good question. How long? Because I do think the trade agreement, whatever the merits and the substance were, it gave people permission to say, okay, now we can bet on a macro turn. But you have to start to see the macro turn this quarter, probably, in terms of the industrial parts of the economy and the freight moving parts of the economy, I would expect. Interestingly, the sub-indexes of the transports all were trying to do better. They've all kind of tried to pull away. And we'll see if this really sets them back.
Yeah. Fastenal, PPG, none of them are doing, again, the industrial sort of,
right.
I don't want to call them bellwethers, but certainly reflections of health there, not looking as good.
No, they're not. And I guess you might have an investor say exactly why you buy Apple and Alphabet here.
Right.
And I think it all kind of fits the same story, because if you're not talking about a recession, if you're not talking about an inverted yield curve, if you're not talking about rates going too high to compromise valuations, and you're not talking about credit stress, what's your catalyst? So right now, the context is the upside catalyst. It's just like stuff's working look, we're getting to a point. It looks like January 2018. We're halfway to that gain we had in 2018 in terms of year to date on the S&P. And it got too much at a certain point, and it didn't take a lot in terms of news flow to set it back.
On the other hand, maybe some of the weakness is this Boeing noise, which we're going to get to more, some incremental news on BA today. There was China data overnight. Let's get to Eunice Yoon in Beijing and go over some of that. Morning, Eunice.
Good morning, Carl. So China's economy grew at its slowest pace since 1990, but it did pick up at the end of the year. So growth in 2019 came in at 6.1%, Q4 at 6% because of the trade war, as well as weaker private consumption. The December data has been raising hopes that the economy here could be bottoming out. The industrial production number blew past expectations. Manufacturing investment came in at 3.1%. This was much stronger than the past 4 months, and that led several research houses to raise their estimates for 2020. Sakjin and Fitch up their estimates to 5.9% growth. Oxford Economics is staying at 6% with an improved outlook. Now, China's leaders have political reasons why they want to see the economy growing at around 6%, mainly because they promised the public here that they are going to double the GDP and incomes from 2010 to 2020. So the Statistics Bureau today said that Beijing would ensure economic growth stays within a, quote, reasonable range and would roll out support measures if necessary. Now, the trade deal is also expected to help stabilize growth. Research firm Capital Economics believes that the tariff relief and reduced tensions will lift GDP by as much as 0.3%. Fitch sees a bump of 0.2%. So that impact might not be as much as people had hoped, but it seems to suggest that a lot of the problems of the economy lie elsewhere. In fact, ANZ today said that they're concerned that consumer spending could be a wild card. They're worried that consumers here are going to continue to hold back because of anxiety over the slowdown. David?
Eunice, thank you. Eunice Yoon reporting for us, of course, live from Beijing. Now back to some corporate news. Late yesterday, our parent company Comcast unveiling details regarding Peacock. It's NBC Universal's entry into the so-called streaming wars. The free version of the service is going to launch July 15th. Consists of 7,500 hours of programming. It is ad-supported, meaning there will be advertisements. The premium service will launch in mid-April on a limited basis. It will have a $4.99 a month cost. That is with commercials as well. It'll be $9.99 if you don't want any ads. In both cases, subscribers will have access there to about 15,000 hours, and it will obviously increase over time of programming. Yesterday, at an event that showcased Peacock, NBC Universal chairman Steve Burke spoke about how the company views the ability to capitalize on streaming.
We think there's a clear opportunity to create a streaming platform that we own and operate, that give people what they want when they want it, but allow us to monetize. We also think we're uniquely positioned to take advantage of this opportunity and play a leadership role in the on-demand streaming world.
The company has positioned itself, guys, in what they believe is a white space, a different area than, of course, the key competition between Netflix and Disney Plus and the coming HBO Max and Amazon and others, and not competing against YouTube or Facebook, where they have user-generated content, or even Tubi, to a lesser extent, Pluto. But this idea of high premium content, ad-supported. And really, when you talk to executives, and I did get a chance to talk to Steve Burke and to Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, prior to the meeting yesterday, in many ways they view the real competitor here as YouTube.
Yeah.
So much time is spent on YouTube. So much of it is, in fact, spent, they say, with NBC Universal content, think SNL, or even The Tonight Show, that has been cut up in parts that really they're not getting any real monetization from. And they would love the opportunity to bring back that content and actually monetize, not to mention, obviously, a very broad portfolio of entertainment, including a bunch of new shows as well, and the ones that you see right there, some of the old favorites from years gone by. That will give them the opportunity, they believe, to sort of benefit in a way, also pointing to Hulu, where it's the ad-supported part of that service that actually is the most profitable and getting as much as $10 in advertising, I think it's per sub. So those are the numbers they're looking at as where they see the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and competing with YouTube, obviously, for eyeball hours and the ad dollars that come with it, and it is a different equation from the pure streamers like Netflix, where it's about Well, we've got to constantly have this impression of newness and abundance just to get people to pay the monthly subscription fee, as opposed to we need them to really latch on in large numbers to what we put out there. And so I do think it's fascinating. Plus, the live piece of it, I guess, is
there is
another
a live aspect
element
to it, which is different. Also, I thought the it was impressive in terms of the user experience, and they've gone a bit about it differently as well. You're going to have live and sports, but it's not as though I don't believe they're going to be streaming CNBC
sure,
on the service.
Yeah.
They're going to be curating sort of towards the bigger stories of the day, but when you go to it, you are going to have that ability to at least look down into a news part of it that gives you information on the bigger stories of the day. The Olympics will be available on the service, but don't expect the NFL or anything like that. However, who knows where things will go over time as this continues, this platform continues to evolve.
Yeah. Also, I mean, there's the affiliate relationships you got to remember. If you're able to see Fallon before it airs on television, that's bending the model in ways we have not seen before.
That's right. And you will be. 8 o'clock is when it's going to be available Eastern time on the service. So yet another reason they hope that they are able to bring what they believe will be as many as 30 to 35 million subscribers by 2024. Remember, the idea is to be break even by 2024, roughly 5 years by the end of 5 years into the service after the service is launched. We've already discussed, and they reiterated, $2 billion in spend over the next couple of years. Programming, marketing, technology, obviously being the key part of that. And there will be some new programs there as well. But the idea is not to spend anywhere near, not to get in these wars in terms of content with the likes of a Netflix spending $17 billion or Amazon or Warner. And we will continue to have content produced at NBC Universal that finds its way into other platforms still.
Yeah, interesting. A lot of fun with the Peacock theme.
Yeah.
In the marketing, and jokes that you can finally watch Law & Order 24/7. That's never been possible.
Yeah.
When we come back, shares of Microsoft has surged more than 300% since Nadella became CEO 6 years ago. You'll hear what he told Jim Cramer about fitting climate change into the company's growth strategy. Take a look at the pre-market here. Downgrades today of IBM, Southwest, Marriott, eBay, Morgan Stanley, Twitter. We'll get to all of that when we return. All right, we got the housing starts number. Let's get industrial production with Rick Santelli. Hey, Rick.
Yes, a minus sign, unfortunately. Down 0.3 for industrial production for December. So that completes the year. Not necessarily a great year. There was 7 negative month-over-month changes, only 5 positive for the 12 months of 2019. And if we look at utilization rates, 77.0 exactly as expected. 77.0 fits in nicely with last month, of course, sequentially, it was upgraded to 77.4. But these are all pretty good numbers. The lowest number of the year was October at 76.6. We have seen rates move up considerably considering how tight the ranges have been, Carl. And a lot of that, of course, happened after more positive data this morning and what's going on globally. David, back to you.
Okay, Rick, thank you. Rick Santelli. Well, in his nearly 6 years as CEO, Satya Nadella has transformed Microsoft. It is now, of course, a trillion-dollar behemoth focused very much so on the cloud. But a new part of the company's strategy for the future involves a goal to be carbon negative by 2030. Last night on Mad Money, Nadella expressed to Jim Cramer his concerns about climate change and how he sees it potentially having an impact on the overall world economy.
The science, I think, at this point is very clear. If the temperatures rise, I think the impact it's going to have on, let's talk about the economy that we all enjoy, or the capitalist system that we all enjoy, I think will fundamentally be in jeopardy if the planet, which is the resource, the factor of production that has fueled all of our capitalist society, will be in danger. So to me, that's the existential priority.
It's been quite a week when you think about it, beginning, of course, with that announcement of a fundamental reshaping of finance. Now, some people took it as a lot of talk from BlackRock and its CEO, Larry Fink, but I still think it was fairly significant in terms of their spending so much time in his letter to CEOs about how they are going to be focused on companies far beyond the metrics of earnings per share and revenues, but including in a significant way their impact and their sustainability goals, and then seeing companies like Microsoft come out with very specific plans to become carbon negative by 2030, and this is even more sort of interesting in some ways, remove all the carbon that they've ever put in the atmosphere
right.
by since 1975
remediate
by
the whole
2050,
thing. Yeah.
which will involve a lot of new technologies that they were talking about, some of which exist, others of which are not fully developed, afforestation and reforestation, soil carbon sequestration, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, and direct air capture.
Right. I don't know.
Direct air capture?
It's kind of amazing.
Carbon out of the air.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of an amazing tiering of motivations for a lot of this, it would seem, right? One, you take it on face value. It's a principled stand. They think it's the right thing to do. Two, dollars are moving in this direction in terms of both younger customers wanting to buy products from companies that reflect these principles, and also just institutional investors doing it. And, you know, I think also there's an employee service aspect to this. You're competing for talent. It seems everything you hear, people under the age of 30 or whatever, want to work for a place that they believe is doing the right thing, and this fits that.
It kind of puts that business roundtable shift in what the corporate mission is in general into sharper relief with every incremental move. Pepsi this week, BlackRock you mentioned, Microsoft. You see this Airbnb news that Chesky Andrew's has given to Sorkin. Yeah. You know, companies are thinking in much different ways.
I mentioned it a lot last year, of course, because it did feel like really you're starting to see the assets accrete to these kinds of strategies where the money is going to be invested. And the companies are responding. The investors are responding, obviously, in terms of BlackRock and the companies themselves. But, you know, they're talking about a 15 metric ton fee that they're going to put in place immediately on all scope of 1 and 2 emissions, scope 3 travel emissions. So everybody in the company is going to be thinking about their own carbon footprint. But for a company like Microsoft, it's also about all their vendors and how they're going to be evaluating them and how those vendors go about delivering the service they do in perhaps a much better way in terms of efficiency and lack of carbon footprint. This is having an impact when, it must be said, our government, of course, is not taking the lead in any way, shape, or form in terms of trying to combat climate change.
And we're in a world where the market is giving Microsoft all kinds of credit to do whatever it wants to do because the stock is working and
right.
profits.
And interesting to hear Nadella tell Jim that Ballmer gave the go-ahead to chase the cloud in many ways,
right.
which was another good piece of news out of Cramer's incredible week. Stocks aiming for another historic day. Taking a look at the futures here. A reminder, you can always catch us live on the go on the CNBC app. Stick around for more Squawk on the Street as we count down to the opening bell in 9 minutes.
We are just about 7 minutes before the opening bell. Let's bring in Slatestone Wealth senior market strategist and a CNBC contributor, Kenny Polcari. Kenny, good morning. Obviously, you and I, everybody looking at this kind of relentless rally, it's orderly. It is really not really given a chance of people to buy dips and pullbacks. Only question is, has it stretched a little bit too far, or can you bet that it keeps rolling?
Listen, I thought it stretched a little bit too far 2 weeks ago, right? I mean, I've actually been expecting. I thought 3,300 was going to be where we actually hit resistance. We tried it a couple of times. We backed off. And then yesterday, we blasted right through and landed solidly on the other side. And again, this morning, look, the markets are up again. Global markets are up. China came out with a fairly decent report, right? Although they're saying 6.1 is the slowest in 27 years or whatever. The fact is, it is growing at 6.1 in the middle of what was this ongoing trade war crisis that was going to bring the global economy to a halt. It's done nothing like that. And so now we've got trade 1.0. We've got China growing. We've got robust U.S. economic data. You've got great earnings so far. And so, you know, the sky's the limit.
So in other words, you know, a lot of the stuff we were worried about seems like we didn't need to be worried about it. Right now, we're almost up 3% year to date for the S&P 500 if we open right here. Most of the strategists out there were saying, we're probably only good for about a 5 or 8% full year. And we're only two weeks in. So what does that mean for the dynamic, people trying to either chase it or upgrade where they think this market could go? And also, how do you treat the first pullback whenever it does come?
So here's what I think, because I'm in that camp where I really kind of thought this year was going to, if we got a 10 to 12% return all in, right, once you add in dividends, total return, I thought that would probably be about where we are. And you're right, we're already up 3%. We're not even done with January yet. We still got another week and a half to go before the month is over. But I think you have to, it depends again on who you are, right? You're the long-term investor, you got to stick with your plan, right? So whether it's consistent investing, monthly, quarterly, set, however you do it, you should stick with that plan and eliminate the noise around you. Look, when you just asked me, we were all concerned about, you know, all these issues going forward. But in fact, we were concerned all of 2019, and the market just kept going higher and higher and higher. It never really pulled back, and it doesn't feel like necessarily today it wants to pull back either. That being said, when the market does pull back, I think there's going to still be plenty of demand. But depending on the speed at which it does, remember, it's all algo-driven. So the buy side will back off a little bit. They'll let the sell side come in. The market should shake the branches a little bit to get everybody to see where everybody stands. But then I think the market's in a very good place.
All right. We'd be in a good place if we shook out a little bit. Kenny, thanks a lot. Good to see you.
Yeah, you as well.
Shakeout does not look like it's going to happen at the open. We're looking for some record highs. Opening bell is just a few minutes away. Don't go anywhere. You're watching CNBC Squawk on the Street, live from the financial capital of the world. The opening bell in less than a minute. It's been a busy week, but we're not slowing down on this Friday. Obviously, commentary out of Druckenmiller and Tepper has helped futures, along with housing starts. We will get to the downgrades, which really have not appeared to be a factor, at least for sentiment at the open. But they do involve some broad names, largely, at least in the case of the IBM downgrade, on the notion that IT budgets remain stretched.
Yes. That was the one kind of macro takeaway from some of the downgrades today. And we'll see how that filters through, if at all. If it's just an excuse, you know, to downgrade IBM when it gets up here.
So let's get to the opening bell and the S&P 500 at the CNBC Real-Time Exchange. At the big board, it's Phoenix Tree Holdings, or Danke, an apartment rental service provider in China celebrating an IPO. We'll talk to the executive chairman of Squawk Alley. At the Nasdaq, Li Shi, an interactive audio entertainment platform in China. So on this IBM downgrade, it's Morgan Stanley. They go to equal weight. Their point is IT budgets are under pressure, especially in hardware, because they argue companies are still digesting the excess capacity they brought in after tax cuts, after a repatriation, after a asset depreciation, and that's essentially a share loss story, they argue, in IBM's case.
Yes, and a particular type of hardware, too. So it does seem as if this is exactly where IBM would be impacted. You see the stock opening up down about 1% right now. Obviously, not been one of the leadership. This isn't characteristic of a lot of the upgrades and downgrades that are going on now, where I think it's a lot of people just trying to reckon with valuation levels, where we've gotten to, and either decide to double down or take money off the table. This is interesting, though, because software has been the comeback story within tech, as well as semis this year. The rest of it seems to get left out. So, I mean, and semis, of course, is a 5G replenishment type story. Yeah.
Of course, IBM, just one of the big names we're going to get next week, along with the Netflixes of the world, a bunch of airlines, our own parent Comcast, P&G. But for the time being, IBM's the big laggard on the Dow, along with UNH. The other one is airlines, and we're still wading through a bunch of airline news regarding Boeing. A story on our website from Leslie Joseph. Street's still trying to come to terms with what additional write-downs may be. This line out of B of A today: we are increasingly fielding concerns from investors regarding the likelihood that the MAX never returns to service.
I mean, I think that's always been the real kind of shadow over this whole story, is it basically a lost generation for Boeing? Don't know that yet. I don't think you can kind of say that, but you know, airlines' patience being tried, them figuring out their capacity situation at this point in the cycle, and all of it fits together. It's a little bit of pressure on that area. And it's again, all the more reason where investment dollars seem to feel like it's just less difficult to buy the obvious stuff. And I don't think that can go forever, but the obvious stuff being the NASDAQ 100, which is dominated by four or five names.
It is stunning, though, to look at those four or five names, or at least a few of them. We have three companies now that are above $1 trillion in market cap. Apple, obviously the leader, Alphabet, and Microsoft. I mean, Apple's market cap is now $1 trillion plus more than an ExxonMobil.
Yeah.
above. In fact, I mean, I can remember a time when ExxonMobil was the most highly valued company, or certainly amongst the top two.
Oh, wait, yeah. Definitely the top.
Or three. Yeah. I mean, the numbers are extraordinary. This move up in Alphabet, approaching 10%, Mike, just this year. It lagged a bit last year.
The dollar values are alarming. And, I mean, obviously you get a little bit of a sticker shock. I do think it makes sense to anchor it somewhere. So these companies, the top three companies, let's call them, right, the top $3 trillion companies, about $3.7 trillion in aggregate market value. Yeah. This year they'll have $140 to $150 billion in net income. It's 25 times earnings for this block of $3 trillion. Okay. Is that insane? Does it make sense? They're the most profitable companies in the history of the world.
What's the blended growth rate, too?
I don't even know. Yeah, I mean, it's double digits. Yeah. I mean, you know, Alphabet insanely still grows close to 20% at its size. Now, if you go back, so Microsoft is twice the market cap it was at the peak in 99. So it was $600 billion back then. It's about $1.2 trillion
right now. It's making way more.
Four times more.
Right.
So it's twice the size, making four times the money. So when do we tip into crazy from just aggressive and complacent? I don't know what that point is. So that to me sets the scene for.
Will you send me a memo when you do know?
I'm gonna put it on the calendar.
Yeah, just keep it quiet. Yeah.
Of course. But yeah. So when to get off the horse in David Tepper terms?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And by the way, Tepper as a credit guy. You know, used to be mostly a credit guy. If you're staring at high yield bonds in aggregate yielding 5%, I don't know if I have something to worry about until that gets disturbed.
Listen, also, so much of it comes back to rates and just where we are and where you can actually get a return. I mean, it's fairly simple.
Druckenmiller has been notably bearish in past years. 2015, he issued a big warning about the future. He does seem to pin a lot of his hopes on the idea that Trump gets reelected.
Right. And and Druckenmiller, though, to his credit, too, even when he was kind of bearish and not sure about policy, he said, own disruptive tech. And that goes back years where he was kind of barbelling things. But I do think he's correct that this leg of the rally has coincided with the betting markets raising the probabilities of President Trump getting reelected. You can't kind of, you know, say that's the main factor, but it's part of the atmosphere that is driving this market, without a doubt.
We don't want to toot our own horns too much, David, but Comcast all-time high. It's been a while since we've been able to say that.
It is. And again, back to market values, $215 plus billion dollars. Not that far away from Verizon any longer, at least within sight, which is always an interesting comparison. But a positive reaction to the unveiling of the company's Peacock streaming services. As we tried to say, and of course, as they spent a lot of time, the executives of the company saying yesterday, trying to differentiate itself from so many of the services that are already out there by having really what they expect will be the most popular part of the service being free. 7,500 hours of programming there, but free, 5 minutes of ad load an hour, by the way, which is low, certainly given our viewers know what typical advertising is in a given hour of television programming. And so that's their expectation and hope. They believe that there is a great deal of demand for digital advertising dollars. Linda Yaccarino, who runs ad sales for the company, made a presentation during yesterday as well. And I've heard numbers as high as they think they could sell 5 billion of digital ads versus the billion that we sell right now.
Yeah, that's an interesting part. The idea that what you're doing is creating digital ad inventory that didn't exist before in a quasi-linear TV way. So that's kind of an interesting element of it. And actually, it mirrors what happened parts of the dot-com boom when newspapers were going online. They said, well, we can't keep up with the inventory. It didn't work for newspapers, but it worked for the overall digital ad economy.
Right. Now, and the question is, how much of that will actually just come from things like YouTube, where shows are watched, where parts of shows are watched, and where, frankly, the monetization for the creator of that content, NBC Universal, is not really being paid?
Also, I mean, you can't discount the legacy, notoriety, and built-in awareness of a name like HBO or Comcast, because reports today that Facebook is retrenching on some of their scripted shows. It's just very difficult to get these shows, get consumers familiar with them. even despite the cost.
Right. Yeah, well, even the whole flap over, oh, Netflix is losing The Office and Friends, there may never be shows like that again, right, where you have that kind of that many episodes, that much popular recognition. And here we have Law & Order trying to get in that league.
Yeah, every one of these has their tentpole, so to speak. Law & Order, certainly that franchise for Disney, The Simpsons, the ability to watch, what is it, 30-plus seasons of The Simpsons, and things of that nature. Yeah.
Really quick on the Fed, we got a couple nominations out of the White House yesterday, Judy Shelton among them, got this 20-year bond out of Treasury to help finance what we know are ongoing deficits. This debate now, Kashkari's tweeting about how it's not QE, the conspiracists who think that this market is pivoting upon QE, that's going to mean, and repo. Right?
Yeah.
When the Fed decides to step back, if they ever do,
sure,
that what's the market going to do then?
I mean, if the market's at a point where it's looking for a reason to say, okay, we've done enough, then it matters. I do think it's, you have to keep going back to the idea that this market was up 25% off the low in October when the repo stuff started. It's up 11% since, and we also got the trade stuff in there as well. So a lot of people want to connect a lot of the dots, and I don't think, you know, if people think it matters, but I don't think that there's a way to draw a true liquidity pipeline from one into equities.
Your point, though, is people believe it is, so
then it doesn't hurt.
Right.
But by the way, people believe the trade deal, that all it did is remove a friction point that was imposed on the market. It didn't get you forward, really, in any material way in the horizon that the markets typically care about.
A couple other stocks we should mention this morning. The Gap, we haven't mentioned the decision to no longer split the company. Yeah. Interesting in that. You know, a lot of shareholders were scratching their head for some time. Shares of GPS of the Gap, I think, are up a bit. Well, nope, actually not doing much right now. Did that news come out yesterday before the close?
No, I think it was after the close.
It was
last
night. Yeah. It was, okay. I wasn't sure.
So it was sort of unwound.
Wanted to make sure if there had been a reaction. And finally, I did want to mention Dave & Buster's. It's small. Obviously, people know it in part because they've been there. But KKR files with a 6.3% of position. And the total purchase price there of that position, given the market cap, is about $77 million. But what's interesting, along with the 16% increase in the stock price, is that KKR does, in the language of their 13D, say that they certainly will consider taking actions concerning any extraordinary corporate transactions, including but not limited to a merger, reorganization, liquidation, sale or transfer of material amount of assets, change in the board of directors and management. It reads like an activist 13D. I called KKR because they don't engage in activism. They were famous for never engaging in what they would call a hostile.
Right.
I'll take it for what it is. Stock's up a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's been some challenging days for Dave & Buster's past couple of quarters. Let's get to Seema and see what's moving on the floor. Dow's up 18. Hi, Seema.
Yeah, up 18 for the Dow, led by technology. In fact, global markets ending the week on a high note, Carl. Japan and South Korea both closing at a 15-month high. Europe right now is at a record high. Looking at the Stock 600, they're up about 1%. All of this following China's GDP, holding on to a 6% level. Yet another sign of stabilization in the world's second largest economy. We're also watching the home builders at this hour after a blowaway housing starts number. The home builders have been outperforming the S&P over the past year. Earnings now will take in focus for Lennar Pultegroup, among some of these other home builders. Turning to CSX and earnings, the railroad's operator revenue decreased 8% year over year in the fourth quarter, driven by a double-digit decline in coal exports. The coal industry has been under pressure in the face of lower-cost natural gas and concerns over emissions, and that's pushed a lot of utilities to retire coal plants in the U.S. and seek cheaper renewable power alternatives. And even with trade tensions easing, CSX on the call saying that it took industrial activity a while to cool off and will take a while to heat back up. That stock down right now. Finally, we've got an IPO here on the floor today. Phoenix Tree Holdings, one of China's largest co-living platforms, which renovates and subleases apartments, pricing a downsized IPO at $13.50 a share. That was well below the expected range of $14.50 to $16.50, and offering 9.6 million shares, down from its original 10.6 million. Remember, Chinese issuers have had a tough year, so we'll see how things shape up in 2020 now with a trade truce, at least for the moment. Guys, Dow currently up 17. Back to you.
Seema, thank you. Seema Modi on the floor. Let's head over to the bond pits now, check in with Rick Santelli at the CME Group in Chicago. Rick.
Morning, David. You know, there's a lot of issues that seem to bug investors lately. Of course, the level of stocks is not one of them, but the level of rates is. Why haven't rates followed stocks more closely? Many times, rates correlate with stocks. Rates go up when things are good and the stock market goes up. This time, not so much. But it's really sparking to the data today. Look at a two-day chart of two-year note yields. The reason I put it two-day is we had spectacular data today, especially on housing, 13-year best in terms of housing starts, and it popped up right up to yesterday's highs, basically, right up to unchanged, 157. It's not 156. It's down one on the week. It's down one on the day because it closed at both at 157. Now, as you move to the longer end, which is really more economically driven, short end's more hampered by where the Fed is with regard to policy, you see the 10-year not only challenged yesterday, it popped straight through. It's now at 183, up two on the day, up one on the week. And it is getting a nice bounce off of it. You see on the next chart, the early December lows, six-week lows that we had on a closing basis the day before yesterday. Finally, the dollar index, like treasuries, today, yesterday's close and the weekly close last Friday are about the same. So dollar index is up a smidge on the day and a smidge on the week. Mike, back to you.
Rick, thank you very much. And when we return, Comcast shares hitting a new record high. We'll get Wall Street's perspective on our parents' launch of Peacock and what it means for the streaming landscape. Squawk on the Street. We'll be right back.
Shares of Comcast, as we mentioned shortly ago, hitting what are all-time highs this morning. Company, of course, revealing new details about the forthcoming streaming platform. We, as in Comcast and NBC Universal, are calling Peacock. Yesterday, the service will launch. It will launch for, by the way, Comcast subscribers on April 15th. Nationwide, though, not until the middle of July. There will be a free ad-supported option as well as two premium pricing tiers. Here's NBC Universal CEO Jeff Shell yesterday about the company's streaming content investment.
I'm pretty confident when you combine all of this content with our proven ability to market and launch new products with Symphony, and then what I think is a really smart strategy of taking light advertising and bundling to create this unbelievable experience free for consumers, this is going to be a very successful product and is going to be one of the key elements of growth for NBC Universal going forward.
All right, let's get some reaction from the street, many of whom were in attendance yesterday. Rosenblatt Securities' Bernie McTernan. Bernie McTernan is here with us, and Cowen's Greg Williams also joins us. Bernie, let me start with you. What'd you think in terms of them trying to carve out at least this idea that they're not competing necessarily with all the current streamers, but in a different area given the ad support and free nature of the service?
And that's certainly the case. We walked away more supportive of the service than we did walking in. Because first, they're partnering with other cable companies. So Peacock Premium, 24 million subscribers in the U.S. will have access to the service for free. Could have another 16 million with Charter coming on board. And then we also think there's a high floor for the service, too, because only $2.5 billion of OpEx commitment for 2024. That compares to Disney Plus at $4.5 billion and Netflix $17 billion. Next year, maybe going to, you know, who knows how high. But then a lower ceiling as well, because right now it doesn't seem like it's going to be global in nature, so only 30 to 35 million subscribers by 20 to 24.
Yeah. Gregory, give me your perspective, particularly from the financial side. Bernie mentioned, obviously, some of the metrics there. 30 to 35 million subs is what they're hoping for within, let's call it, 4 to 5 years when they get to break even. Is that something that makes sense to you? Are you concerned at all about the spend?
Sure. I think that the break-even is very doable. 30 to 35 million subscribers is very doable, especially if it's free. It's going to be an advertising-driven model for a lot of the segment. It's going to be about monetizing that advertising a little bit higher than, say, Hulu does, because they said $6 to $7 ARPUs, but it's only going to be 5 minutes of advertising. So they're going to need to do really good targeted advertising in order to get a higher CPM. As far as the financials and overall picture, they said a lot of that in December already. $2 billion investment over the next 2 years, break even in 2024. So not a lot of things that would move the stock necessarily in the next 2 days because a lot of that information is already well known.
Bernie, a big question with a lot of these new entries in streaming is how much of it is a zero-sum game? How much of the new business is really just going to be trying to cover for what's being lost on the traditional side? For Comcast, how does that shake through the model?
Well, that's certainly the big question, is how much more cord cutting will this inspire? So with media companies, you can extend your reach, and that's why you want to go direct to consumer, but how much are you going to cannibalize the existing part of the business? For the cable side of the house, they only make a 30% margin on video, so it's really, you know, broadband share gains is still a great story for the company. company going forward.
You know, Greg, on that point, I mean, we're looking at new highs in Comcast. I believe you have a hold on the stock. Peacock is an important initiative. It's going to be taking some money. But what is your overall take right now in terms of where the company is, in terms of the value that the market is ascribing to it?
Yeah, absolutely. Last year, the company performed pretty much in line with the S&P 500. We expect a similar performance in 2020. This first half of the year, Peacock is really not going to be that catalyst. As of yesterday, we know that what we're going to get with Peacock. So now they're focusing on the other investors. Investors are worried a little bit about Sky. Investors are looking at the mobile venture they're going into. And, of course, the healthy broadband market in the U.S. and Comcast's ability to take advantage of that, which we're bullish on. But these are the focuses now, and Peacock is now sort of, I don't want to say an afterthought, but now we can move that aside and focus on Sky and mobile.
Bernie, what are you going to be looking for in terms of penetration of the service once it gets going? Are metrics going to become important here?
Yeah, and so a key question coming out of this is, are we already at peak number of subscribers getting Peacock Premium for free? Because we know video subscribers are going to keep going down and broadband-only subs are going up. But what will that attach rate be of Flex boxes? Because right now you only get the service for free if you're a Comcast video customer or Cox video customer and you have the Flex service with broadband only. So how, you know, with services like Roku out there, how will they make sure that Flex is an important part of that broadband only household?
And taken all together, does it do anything to mute Netflix's domestic subscribership, or where does it play for Netflix?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the biggest impact will be on pricing power. You know, with Disney Plus coming in at a lower price than expected, same with Apple TV Plus, Peacock for free to 24, maybe going to 40 million customers over time. That next big price increase could be a long ways off for Netflix, at least domestic.
Are you in the school that Netflix does need to have some ad-supported, lower-priced product?
I think it's going to be tough for them, too, because it would be admitting defeat. Well, that the,
it would be a U-turn, no doubt.
Exactly. We have a neutral rating on the stock, $265 price arc, because we expect revenue growth to substantially decelerate from 29% growth last year to 23%, going to high teens. And because of that, we're putting a 4.5x revenue multiple on 2021 revenue and get to a $265 target.
No doubt it is a different marketplace this year than it was even a year ago in
exactly.
terms of who's out there for Netflix.
One of the secret sauces for Netflix was their distribution. And now that distribution, IP, streaming, direct-to-consumer, that's now everyone can do it. It's now it's content that matters the most.
Bernie, Greg, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be sure to check out our podcast. Listen to the Opening Bell Hour or Squawk on the Street wherever you get them. Dow up 32 and the S&P 3322. We're less than 600 points from Dow 30K. Let's take a look at the NASDAQ 100's best performers since the beginning of the year. Tesla at the top of the list with a 21% gain. Over 12 months, 46%. Over 6 months, 100% gain on Tesla.
You've been listening to the Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.